Happy Thursday, Nod Pod. Thank you guys so much for joining me for another episode. Y'all are never going to believe what I just did. Actually, you probably will. I just recorded this episode that I'm about to do, and after 30 minutes realized that the mic wasn't on. And so I was talking to space for 30 minutes, which that part's not that bad because I often just talk into space, but I can't believe I just spent 28 minutes recording and I wasn't recording anything. So this is actually the second time I'm doing this. And welcome if this is your first time here. Hi, my name is Janine. After 15 years of a crippling drug and alcohol addiction, in January 2015, I finally broke the patterns. And this show is about how I broke the patterns and how other people broke patterns and how we are living successful lives in recovery now and exactly how we did that and exactly how you can do that with a lot of laughter and entertaining and poignant and moving stories along the way. So for my friends in early recovery, it's so hard to see past 30, 60, 90 days and see a future, especially when there are so many challenges. And what you're going to hear today is how those challenges, not just in recovery, but even our challenges in addiction, are teaching us behavioral patterns and giving us insights that increase the quality of our life so much later. You are learning tools in your early recovery path, and sometimes even in our addiction, that will put you so much further ahead of the game in a few years from now or sooner. If you own a business or you go back to work or you go back to school or you're a mom or you get your kids back or you get married, you will have insight and tools because of these challenges right now. And I know that that's so hard to see, but I know that you're going to get that out of today because I never would have seen that the insights that I got in my early recovery around these couple of stories I'm going to share would help me now. And they are. And for my friends in longer term recovery, I invite you as I go through this process today, I invite you to go through these stages of change, of awareness with me on anything going on with you right now, because some insight that I had in my early recovery is going to make my marriage better today, 9 years later. And I just realized this today. I was going back through older episodes because I thought I was going to have to do another rerun today. And apologies, I know the last two episodes were reruns, but they were from a long time ago. So I'm assuming a lot of you guys maybe hadn't heard them. And the NDPE is obviously hilarious. And then Strong Arm Robbery is probably my favorite episode we've ever done. And it was so great to hear Kim like laughing. And, you know, it was nice to listen to our report. So I hope you guys did still enjoy them. I was maybe going to do another one. And I realized I was listening to older episodes that I often reference being arrested while eating an M&M McFlurry, a McDonald's M&M McFlurry, many times. I like make a joke about it and then say, I've shared those stories before here, right? Yeah, I think I have, but I never really did. I did one of them, but not the other two. And I'm going to share all three of them today. But in addition to being obviously entertaining and insane, like who gets arrested while eating the same thing three times, except for my sponsor who got arrested while wearing green nail polish four times, which is crazy. But as Narcan Nate pointed out when I was talking to him about some of this, it's not actually that crazy because we were addicts who were breaking the law every single day for years. We just happened to be eating a McFlurry a few of those times. And I get that, but still, it's a little weird. But the revelation I had around these arrests and early recovery gave me a revelation about my marriage today with Skylar and some accountability that I need to take that is going to make our relationship so much better. Also, somebody asked me recently what's going on with him because I wasn't giving weekly updates anymore. And I so appreciate that. I actually wasn't doing it because I don't know. I didn't want to blow you guys up with all of these updates, but I really appreciate that somebody cared enough to ask. He's doing well. He's at 4 months, but even more than him having the time, because he has had time before, unlike me, he'll get like a while, but with no recovery. And so I think what is a better sign to me now, what I'm heartened about more, is that he has a sponsor that he calls consistently, and he's doing step work with that sponsor. They meet on Sundays. They go to a meeting together. It's not a men's meeting, but it's mainly men that go, and they meet, they do step work. He's on his eighth step now. And he's doing recovery stuff. So he is doing much better. And his brain is coming online a little bit more too. And y'all, I've never seen this. So if this is something that you have experience with, DM me, let me know. It took so long for him to be able to think straight again. He's still not even all the way back. And I don't mean just like kind of, I would be in rehab and I couldn't really read that well the first few months, but I could. He was missing words. It was hard for him to understand people. It was hard for him to read. The psychosis was still around. He would get emails at work and think they were suspicious. The psychosis was present for a while. This took so much more of a toll on him than I've seen take on any other addict in my entire life. I mean, at 4 months, he's still reeling from the effects, but it is better. And he told me recently he was so scared because he thought he was going to be like that forever. And I can't imagine how scary that was, thinking that he was never going to have his intellect or his faculties again. But he's feeling better. He's feeling more apt and able at work and in our relationship to have conversations, etc. So first, Eminem McFlurry arrest. So this is also coincidentally my very first arrest. It was a DUI. And I always looked at this arrest really differently. I think I attached some socioeconomic cliches to it, because it's very different to get arrested being pulled out of the bushes with heroin on tinfoil and like black smudges on your hands. And this arrest, where I was kind of dressed up, I was driving back to my place. I had been at a sushi bar in La Jolla, a really nice sushi bar, drinking apple martinis. I bailed myself out that night. I blew a .09, which is like, it's not great, but it's not that bad. That could be a wet reckless. And I had all of these reasons for kind of dismissing this DUI. It felt like I had never even been arrested because of some of those circumstances. So I was working at this boutique in La Jolla, and I really liked my boss. I don't know if any of you have worked for women that own by themselves a boutique retail shop, like a really nice one. They're very similar. They're driven and really successful. And in a lot of ways, they can have challenging personalities. And she was like definitely one of them. But I admired her a lot. She had done $1 million in revenue the year prior based on this one line of denim that she found that like no one else had. And they were amazing jeans. Actually, I had a few pairs that got stolen from me in Choices, of course. But anyways, I digress. She wanted me to go have a drink with her and sushi after a shift. And I really did not want to do this. I lived in Oceanside, which is far away from La Jolla. It's like 45 minutes away, and I had to drive back. But, you know, I liked her and I didn't want to make her mad. So I went and I had 2 or 3 apple martinis. And 2 weeks prior to this, I was on a date with, I think I have mentioned this person before. I've probably never thrown a name out there, but there is one guy in my history that was difficult for me to get any sort of commitment from. Not difficult, impossible, just one. And I feel lucky in that regard. Like, you'll see TV shows or friends that never know where they're at in a relationship. And I feel very lucky that was not something that I went through. Within a few months, any of my long-term boyfriends said, let's be committed, you know, but this one guy kept getting away from me for years. And we were off and on for years. And I liked him a lot. But I wouldn't ever show that because I, you know, kind of knew how he was and he had a bit of a reputation. So I wouldn't show how much I liked him, but I liked this guy a lot. And we were out a few weeks prior to this night that I get the DUI, and we're at a bar, and it was a bunch of his friends that I had never met before. And his friends were really snobby. And anytime I met his friends, I felt super out of place. And as I say that, looking back, they might not have been snobby, but I always felt like poor and like a loser. This is when the not finishing college stuff still really bothered me. And this is like in my late 20s, early 30s, really bothered me. I hadn't really found my way in fitness yet. And so I felt super out of place. I was always wildly like underdressed. And we just were from like really different socioeconomic backgrounds. And I felt that when I was around his friends. So I'm with him and his friends, and we're at this bar. And he starts seriously hitting on the bartender, like in front of me, in front of his friends. And it was so uncomfortable. And I'm off to the side trying to be the cool girl, like I didn't notice, but I, of course, did. And so finally, one of his friends says, let's go across the street, go to another place. And I'm thinking, oh, thank God. And he says, y'all go on ahead. I'm going to stay here. And I walk outside with his friends, and we're all standing there in a circle while, you know, somebody was smoking or something, and they were waiting to see if he was going to come out. And it was so humiliating. The girls were kind of looking at me like, is she really just going to stand here and wait? You know, who knows what they were thinking. The guys couldn't make eye contact with me. And finally, one of them said, all right, I'm going to go get him. And I said, all right. And he comes back out a minute later and he was like, he said to just go on ahead. And he was like looking at the ground. And I wanted to die of embarrassment. So I go across the street with his friends who I do not know to another bar. I even bought myself a Jack and Diet Coke and I'm standing off to the side drinking my drink. And then I finally realized what was happening. And I was like, what am I doing? I just bought myself a drink waiting for this asshole who's hitting on someone else for what? If she doesn't go for it, then he's going to come here. This is absurd, you know? So I put my drink down and I remember saying to one of the girls, not like they cared, but I said, hey, I'm going to go to the bathroom. And I bolted. And then I even drove down the street one more time to see if he was on his way over. And he wasn't, and I'm ashamed to admit this, but if I'd seen him, I probably would have pulled over and like gotten out of the car, but I didn't. He was never even coming. And I was brokenhearted that night, literally drove home in tears. So cut to, I don't know how much longer, 2-3 weeks later, I'm at this sushi restaurant in La Jolla with my boss, and I go to the restroom, and in line for the restroom is one of the girls from that night, one of his friends. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, okay, I'm sure she won't even recognize me. And she does. And she says, oh, you're so-and-so's friend from a few weeks ago. And I said, yeah. And she had the grace to say something like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. He does that kind of stuff all the time, which was true, which I knew. And I said, yeah. And then I couldn't help myself. I said, what even ended up happening that night? And she says, oh my God, he like, fuck that bartender in her car in the parking lot. You guys, I couldn't even believe that when she told me that. And to her, I was like, oh, of course, you know, whatever. But I was so upset. I remember going to the bathroom, walking back to the table where my boss was. And I said, I'm out of here. I'm going to go home. I got to go home. And I still had like an hour drive and it's 11 o'clock at night. I'm driving home, smoking cigarettes, crying. Listening to, do you guys remember that Christina Perry song, Jar of Hearts? It's like, who do you think you are? I shouldn't sing it. Run around, leaving scars. That song? Listening to that song on repeat on my neon pink iPod mini. Listening to Jar of Hearts. I cannot believe I'm telling you guys this. It's because I'm sitting on the floor. Our office is still dismantled and I'm sitting on the floor. That's why I'm saying so much. It feels like I'm just talking to like a friend, which I guess I am just talking to friends. Listening to Christina Perry, Jar of Hearts, smoking cigarettes, crying on my way home. So at some point, I remember that Evan, who I had just met a few weeks prior, was at my house hanging out with my roommate. And I had just met him, and he was so obnoxious, but very good looking. And I knew that he kind of liked me, but I was super not interested. But in that moment, I was like, you know what? Fine. I'm going to text that guy. And he was at the house. And I was trying to say, like, I'm on my way home or something. And he wasn't understanding me, which happened a lot. And I remember being annoyed as I'm texting him. I'm exiting right by my house. There's a McDonald's right there. I go through the McDonald's. I get an M&M McFlurry. And as I'm leaving the drive-thru, I'm texting him and looking at my phone, annoyed. And I get lit up and pulled over. And I get arrested for the first time, right? And that was my DUI. So M&M McFlurry, I put it in the cup holder as I get out. And they actually were nice and they didn't tow my car that time. So the next day I went back to get it and it was all like melted in the cup holder. Also why I remember. So that happens. Cut to a year later. By now, a lot is different in my life. I'm with Evan. We end up getting together, staying together. And by that point too, I'm strung out on heroin, still just smoking. I lived in a decent place. I had my Jeep. I was still working and teaching. So it was pretty early on in my heroin use, but I was definitely at the point where I would have been sick if I didn't have it. I'm, you know, smoking, but managing to still like live my life. So we go to McDonald's and I let him drive and he has no license, of course, and not just no license, but a suspended license. He had gotten multiple DUIs and suspended license. I'm doing a crossword puzzle, which I don't know why I kept doing crossword puzzles in my addiction. I think it was because I don't do them now and I didn't do them prior. I think it was like, oh my God, Also, I just remembered something that happened when I was doing one of them once. I'll share it in a second. But I think it was maybe my way of connecting to my brain or something. I don't know. It's also like how, you know, addicts, we buy scratchers all the time and we often buy the crossword scratchers. What is that about? Because I don't buy them now. But anyway, I was doing a crossword once from an Us Weekly. And I remember some of the letters were filled in. And I remember asking Evan, though I thought he wouldn't know if he knew the answer. And he was like, "You're not going to believe me. I think it's don't tase me, bro," which is like a line from something. And I said, "That's not what it is. You're an idiot." And as I did more, I realized it was don't tase me, bro. He was right. Whatever that's from, he was actually right. That was like the quote in the crossword. So I'm doing a crossword puzzle and I have the dome light on. You know that meme that floats around that says your mom said that it was illegal to have the dome light on and that was wrong? No, that was right. I got pulled over for having the dome light on, although I've never checked into this, but that's what they said that they were pulling us over for. So we're in the Jeep. I'm doing a crossword puzzle. My feet are barefoot up on the dash. He's driving, no license. And I had fake tags on my car. I had not paid my registration. So I was deep enough in my addiction that though I had a job, I was doing things like putting fake stickers on my car. So fake tags, go through the drive-thru, get an M&M McFlurry, leave the drive-thru, get lit up. So we get pulled over and I know he's going to jail because he always goes to jail. And he is the bad guy in the scenario. He is the villain in the story of my life. So I know he's going to go to jail. And in fact, he had a 20 of heroin in his cigarette packs, in his cigarette pack. And they pull both of us out of the car because there's the fake tags and he doesn't have a license. So they pull both of us out and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, okay, well, they're going to take him to jail and then I guess I'll just go back to the house. And Evan and I are making eye contact across the top of the Jeep on opposite sides of the car as the cop pats him down, pulls out his cigarettes where the dope is, opens the top and immediately flips it back and puts it in his pocket and didn't see it. And so both of us are like, oh my gosh. And I'm thinking, okay, well, they're just going to, you know, let me drive home. It turned out that I have a warrant out for not doing my MAD classes for that DUI. I had done the DUI school and I was paying the fine still at that point, I'm pretty sure, but I hadn't done the MAD class and I had a warrant and they took me to jail on that warrant. And that time they did tow my car. They just left him on the sidewalk, towed my car. And that time, as they were walking up to ask us to come outside, to step outside of the car, I remember putting the M&M McFlurry in the cup holder. And I was like, this is weird. Have I done this before? Like, what? And then immediately, though, it's like, Coulter, step out of the vehicle. I'm like, fine, fine, fine. So I get out. They take me to jail. And I had this incredibly surreal moment where I'm in the back of the car. He's standing on the sidewalk. And I'm driving away in this cop car. And we're making eye contact. And I was like, this is so wrong. He's the bad guy. He's the drug addict. I'm me. I'm not supposed to be the person in the cop car. And it was like this incredibly disassociative moment. And then when I got there, again, because I was strung out, and that was probably the first time I was encountering a period of time where I might have started to get sick, I kept calling Evan every few hours. And I was actually able to bail myself out. So bail on the first DUI was $2,500, so $250 to get out. Bail on this, it was $5,000 and I think it was $500 to get out. And I actually bailed myself out. I was able to make a payment. So early on in my addiction, I'm in the holding and I'm calling Evan over and over and over again. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, just make sure that as soon as I get out, I get to have a cigarette from your pack, right? You know, you need to save me a cigarette, one of your cigarettes, not one of mine, like trying to get across to him to get me well. And I remember after the third time calling him, he finally said, "Janine, I know exactly what you're saying. Every chick in holding knows what you're saying. And the sheriff listening to this phone call knows what you're saying. I got it." And I remember thinking, okay, fine, fine, fine. So second arrest with an M&M McFlurry. Next arrest is 18 months later. It was the day after Christmas and super extreme progression. Again, now I'm homeless, lost all my jobs, lost that Jeep. Gone through choices the first time, living in sober living. Actually, the same sober living that I ended up getting clean in later. And while I'm here, I want to take a second to say that I make social media jokes about sober living skits sometimes. And I get so worried because sometimes people jump in and they're like, yeah, that's right. That's why I'd never go to one. And to be clear, I think you guys listening know this. I'm a proponent of sober living. If you are fortunate enough to be able to stay in one, to be ensconced in a recovery setting with people that also have a similar goal and are maybe also beginning again. And so you don't feel as bad if no one has a car, everyone's on EBT, you know, everybody's getting Medi-Cal or whatever. It's so nice to be in that environment. Don't bring your nicest stuff and you're going to have annoying roommates who snore and leave dishes soaking in the sink for 3 hours. Like all that's going to happen, but it's not a bad thing. And when I make those skits, I get kind of bummed sometimes because I'm like, I don't know how the joke is being missed here. It's like, if you make a joke about your personal trainer giving you a hard time, but obviously you still want to work out. Anyway, for the record, my stance on sober living is good. So I'm in my sober living and there was another sober living down the street. And this, I guess, is an example of some of the bad ones where they were super lax. You could even use in the house. It was a co-ed sober living and we were staying there overnight with another friend of ours who was in the sober living because we were getting high all night. And the next like late morning, we get up to walk back to mine. And it's the day after Christmas and we're walking back and we go to McDonald's and I get an M&M McFlurry for breakfast and we're in the parking lot of a Walgreens. My dad had sent me a Walmart gift card for Christmas. So my gift card and my best pass were both in Evan's backpack in his wallet. And at that point I was on the methadone clinic and I wanted my best pass to go to the clinic to get my dose because I had an audition at a spin studio in Encinitas right across the street, actually from what ended up being Cybrid. And the odds of me getting to that audition on time are like zero, but you know, ostensibly I was going to go. And so I wanted my gift card and I wanted my bus pass. And Evan sometimes was irrationally difficult out of nowhere. And you guys have heard me say on the show, I've come to such a peace with him. I think that in a lot of ways he was helpful in my life and he was just doing the best that he could too. And I think he's doing well now, which makes me really happy. He's married. He looks happy. So I'm not even really saying anything bad about him. It's mostly confusing because out of nowhere, he would become incredibly unreasonable and difficult, like on purpose. And I just simply said, hey, let me get my gift card from you real quick. I'm going to just run to the clinic, whatever. And he said, no, I'm not giving it to you. And started walking away from me. And I was confused. And it's like, give me my gift card. Give me my bus pass. Give me my, you know, and we start fighting. And I'm grabbing his backpack and like slamming it into him. And we're getting closer to the Walgreens doors. And I remember they start opening and closing the automatic doors, which matters later too, because all of this was on their security camera from the front of the store. And then I take his hat off and he turns around and I hit him with his hat, which matters. That's how I got the whole charge. Because I guess like pulling back is one thing, but then making contact is another part of the statute. I don't know. Hit him with his hat, whatever. Of course, the cops come. Before the cops get there, he's like running away from me and I'm running in the opposite direction, screaming at him. And the cops show up and I watched the cop run up and tackle him. Oh, and this is important. I forgot this part. As we were leaving the other sober living, there was a random jacket on the couch of the other sober living that Evan just picked up and threw on to just take. To just steal from whoever lived there. So he gets tackled. As he gets tackled, firecrackers fall out of the pockets of that jacket. So I don't know whose jacket that was or why they had firecrackers, but he ended up actually getting arrested and charged with possession of firecrackers, which is so bizarre because we didn't deal in firecrackers. I don't know why they were at the sober living, but he gets smacked. And I remember he was like, whoa, wait, what? As like firecrackers were falling out of his jacket. They sit me down, they sit him down. And my McFlurry, I'm sitting down next to on the curb. And that time, finally, I was like, holy shit, this is real. This is the third time I've been arrested with a McFlurry. I'm never eating one again. I did end up getting arrested that day and charged with domestic violence. And that was, of course, the last time that I ate an M&M McFlurry. So what is the common denominator in those three stories besides the M&M McFlurry? I've always thought the common denominator was Evan. I never got arrested until I met him. And after he left, I never got arrested again. The last time I got arrested was like 3 weeks before he left California forever. I attached so much of what had gone wrong for me to blaming him. What I came to realize over time in recovery that something else was present in all three of those stories, which was my alcoholism and addiction that I've always had my entire life. And I remember my friend Gumpy, who's been on the show before many years prior to this, when I was still in LA, we were talking about my boyfriends. And he said, there is no pattern to the guys that you date. They don't look alike. They don't do similar things. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, huh? Because most people have like a type and mine look completely different. They all did different things. And he said, but you know what they do have in common? If you put them in a room and gave them like a bottle of Jack and a joint, they would get down. And I remember laughing and thinking, oh, that's so weird, though. You know, my dad's not an alcoholic. And usually you like people that are like your dad. My dad's not an alcoholic. How weird. And it never even occurred to me, Janine, you're the alcoholic. That's why you're going out with them. The other thing present in those three arrests was my alcoholism and addiction. Releasing that blame for someone isn't even for them. He couldn't care less. He's gone. Living in resentment and feeling like a victim of someone else is a challenging way to live, and it limits us in so many ways. And taking back accountability is such an empowering choice, because if everything that happened to me was as a result of someone else's choices, then how can I get anything different if I'm not in charge of my life? So it's actually quite disempowering to say someone else was in charge of my existence. They made these bad choices, which is why my current circumstances look like this. Because if you're assigning them that power, then how do we ever make any changes? And I came to that awareness with Evan a long, long time ago. You guys have heard me share on the show before. I had that sponsor that came to my rehab once, and I said, look, I'm not really an addict. I just accidentally got strung out on heroin, which you have to do every day, but I'm not really an addict. And she said, okay, like, I hear you, but just so you know, regular people don't accidentally get strung out on heroin. And she, of course, was right. I thought about like my girlfriends from high school, and if they were dating a guy and found out he was on heroin, they would break up with him. They wouldn't go down that road. And I had to really take accountability and look at the fact that this was not his fault. And I had a huge part in this. I did coke before I met him. I was only even in San Diego because I'd done so much coke in LA. I wasn't welcome anywhere. And that was why I was even down there. So I took accountability for all of that stuff a really long time ago. And so for my newer friends in recovery that are listening, these early insights that we get through whatever recovery modality you're using, if maybe you're just going to therapy, maybe you're just listening to stuff like this and taking it in, maybe you are doing step work and a sponsor is walking you through some of this stuff, because it was Rachel that helped me see a lot of this stuff and just all of the different things that I'd heard as I'd come in. Please know that in the early days, I couldn't see any of that. And I was so angry with him. Even when I was detoxing at my friend's house for the last time, I remember crying to Rachel and saying, I can't believe this is my life. I'm almost 35. I have nothing. And it is all Evan's fault. If I had never met him, I never would have even seen heroin. I had never seen it before. And I remember she cut me off and she was like, Janine, you don't know that. You don't know that. You're not God. You don't actually know that. You don't know that you never would have seen it. And that's far from the most profound thing she ever said to me, but for some reason it stopped me. And I thought, I guess I don't actually know. Maybe that is true. You know, I guess I don't actually know. But I was mired in the early months with my blame of him. And it was a years long process where I started to gain a little insight into my involvement in that whole process, which is quite empowering. How is this relevant now at 9 years? So for those of you that have been listening to this show for a while, know that my husband was recently using, and not just like a little bit using, all the way full blown, 18 months, strung out, all the things, got fired, lied to me, all the attic things. And also when we sold our last business, we had a bit of a nest egg put aside, and it is at zero now, or close to zero, like $300 left or something. And I have been so bitter at him for spending so much money And he did get us into a jam with doing check cash loans and stupid stuff like that and pulling money out from savings and stuff like that before I realized what was happening. But I moved most of it over when I realized what was happening. And I was at that point in charge of what went where. And his check would be taken by a check cash loan. And so I had to use ours to cover rent and stuff because his pay was more than mine. He was the sole breadwinner at that point. And it would be gone to check cash places. And I would have to pull money over and pull money over and pull money over. So a few things. One, I didn't have to pull money over. I could have taken Tank and left and gone somewhere else. And he couldn't have fought me for that money. He would say that, you know, he'd be like, we're married, 50% of that's mine. But, you know, what's he going to do? You know, get a lawyer. He was fully strung out. So I could have done that. I chose to keep this house. But even more than that, we were recently doing a budget because I said, and he's working now and I'm working now. And I said, we've got to budget because we've ripped through our whole studio nest egg, whatever. So we start like writing down all the things. And I see that, you know, I have two Audible accounts. I get green juice delivered once a month for $169, which is so much money, or once a week. That's so bougie to have organic cold pressed green juice delivered to your house. I have a hair membership, like for blowouts. That's expensive. My lashes, my Botox. It's a lot. And it's more than we've been making if you put it together. My Amazon charges, my pre-workout is fucking $50. And as we're looking at that, I was faced with, this is me too. I have such a part in this. It, for one thing, is empowering because if I have a part in it, I can make a change. But more importantly than that, it allows me to not be angry at my own husband that I live with. And my mom told me that after my dad left, anyone looking at her position would think, fuck, man, you got rocked in this divorce. Like, married 25 years. He made all the money. He was a pilot. She traveled with him around the world, meaning she wasn't building a 401k anywhere. And he left. And she was in her 40s and hadn't worked in a long time. You guys know the drill. This is common. And was terrified and so angry that he had left her in this position, which I understand. But she, within a few years, wasn't angry at all anymore. And she speaks so highly of my dad. If he comes up, she's like, oh my God, he's the funniest man. He's so athletic. Father of the year. Like, all this stuff. And I don't remember how it came up, but at some point I remember talking to her about it. And what she did was, she said, I was so angry. I couldn't see straight. I was so mad at him and betrayed. They've been together since they were like 17. And she said, so I went in my room and I shut the door and I locked it and I sat down with a notebook and I went through every year of that marriage and I wrote down everything wrong that I had done every year. And by the end of a 25-year marriage, I had done a lot. I had done a lot and I had a part also. It's essentially a four-step, right? It's a four-step, though she didn't know that. And she released the anger and the bitterness. She was able to do that and move on. And of course she met Mike. And so releasing that anger allows us to have that relationship again. And so if I can say, cause I've been pissed about the money, y'all, I've been pissed. Like, we'll be sitting there sometimes on the couch and I'll be looking at him and I'm like, you motherfucker, we should be able to travel and we can't. And again, don't get me wrong. Most of this is because of his choices. Okay. But I am not absolved. The monthly expenses, you know, being exorbitant and needing to like take my part in this also. And it allows me to not feel that way so that we can actually do the healing work that we need to do because we're committed to this marriage, you know, and for it to be an enjoyable one, we have to get to this place. And I learned that lesson initially through getting arrested while eating McFlurries, you know, and I never would have connected those two things. So again, my friends in early recovery, some of those things that just seem so stupid and that you're so embarrassed about, you are gleaning insight that is going to put you leagues ahead of the people in your life in terms of awareness, self-awareness. So I was planning this episode, and then I heard the coolest thing. I was listening to Tony Robbins. I also want to interject here that I love a lot of what Tony Robbins has to say, but I don't love everything he has to say. For example, I was listening to him on the Theo Von podcast, and Theo Von was like, oh, I'm 17 days off antidepressants. And Tony Robbins was like, good for you, brother. And Theo Von was like, yeah. And I just kind of stopped and I was like, are we saying good for you? He's a comedian. Sometimes they get depressed. Like, chemically, he may have had an imbalance, you know. And Tony Robbins like kind of went on this little baby rant about how antidepressants like aren't that really good for you. And I don't know, like, I have limits with what I believe because I've seen antidepressants work miracles on people in my life that are clinically depressed. And so that line of thinking is dangerous. And so I just want to say, anytime you guys hear me quote somebody or talk about someone that I admire, I don't necessarily sign on to all of the things that they believe, nor should you guys sign on to all of the things that somebody is saying, right? That also limits the scope of what we love. I shared this a few weeks ago that I heard this quote, true intelligence is being able to hold two opposing ideas at the same time. And I think I used Skylar as the example that day and said, Skylar did all these things and lied and used. He has also made my life a lot better. And I married him for a reason. I think I also used my friend Jana. We had this huge falling out. You know, Jana lied about the business, or actually she didn't, but, you know, I thought she was shady about these things, blah, 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 blah. But she's also been really good. You know, we can hold two opposing things. And so I can say that Tony Robbins has brilliant mindset work, but I don't love this weird anti-medication thing that he has. So anyways, I just want to state that for the record, like, loving the way that he speaks about cognitive thinking doesn't mean I, you know, sign on everything that he says. And so anyways, I digress. This is what Tony shared today. Four things have to happen chemically in the brain for change to happen. The first thing is satiation, being sated, being completely full of something. You've experienced like all of it. And there's no more left for you to get. So for us in recovery, you know, I never got to a point where I probably would have felt like I've done all the drugs that I could do. But you often hear people say they stop working in the same way that they did. For me, it always got me well. But I remember in the shed, he was bringing me dope that had like a reddish tint to it. And the consistency was weird. And it definitely didn't hit the same. And that is when I left. And I left with some on me and I didn't even care. You know, I kind of had enough of the dope. Now, you catch me 2 days later when I'm sick, obviously I would do more. But like the day to day, I'd had a lot of heroin and meth in my body, you know, like I'd had it all. There was no more drugs left for me to do. There was no more excitement around it. I'd done all the drugs that my body could take. The second change that has to happen is dissatisfaction. So I've had all the dope that I can have, but I'm also not satisfied with the results anymore. I'm not enjoying it anymore. So we have satiation. We've got all of it. We're not happy with the results anymore. And what we tell ourselves to get through that period is that in the future, it'll be different because in the past it was different. So right now it sucks, but in the future it'll be different. And that's the dissatisfaction stage. The next stage is threshold, where you realize that no, it was always bad and it's always going to be bad. And I've reached my limit. And that's the threshold. And for me, with using, that was so true to finally understand that this was never going to be different. I was always going to end up on public transportation, strung out on heroin and homeless. That story was always going to end for me that same way. And I had to get really clear about my previous experiences with it. And that's the threshold. So we've had all of it that we can have. There's no more that we want. Dissatisfied with what's happening. We believe it will always be this way. And then we have an insight about that, which is why has it always been this way? It's always been this way because I do too much and I'm always an addict and I end up homeless. I don't just party, right? Or like that's the insight. And then in that insight, we have a tiny opening to make a change. And to me, that's also like the moment of clarity that they talk about in recovery. And he says that insight and that opening for change is very brief. And then you might go back and repeat the cycle. And I was thinking today, so if that was true for me with my addiction, which I can see that it was, how can I find this in my current situation? And I was thinking about this with the money and with Skylar. Sated. I have had all of the broke ass experiences you can have. I've been evicted. I've had cars towed. I've had phones shut off. I've had all of the negative experiences that you can have. I've had accounts closed, overdraft fees, people calling me for money, can't get a credit card. All of the negative experiences you can have with money have happened to me, right? All of the evidence of financial irresponsibility and satisfaction. I'm super dissatisfied with this, right? With this condition. And I have always believed deep down that it will be different when I can just do XYZ, right? Like after we sell the studio or podcast takes off, like it will be different. If Skylar hadn't used, it would be different, which brings us to the threshold, which is, but has it always been this way? And the answer to that for me is yes. I was broke in Georgia. I was broke in LA. And I've been broke in San Diego long before I met and married him. I have always been struggling. That's the threshold. And the insight there is that that's me. And the opening and the moment of clarity is it's on me to make a change. And I would love to hear from some of you guys what you think about that, what I just said, because for me, that was just really mind-blowing. Satiation of whatever it is, you've had enough. Let's say it's food. You've had enough. Dissatisfaction with the results. Threshold, we've had enough. We believe we need to make a change. And then insight, which is typically going to be, I am at the center of all of this. That's dissatisfying for me. And that's our opening into change. And I learned that years ago, that the presence of a McDonald's McFlurry and Evan were not causal to me getting arrested, because correlation is not causation, right? Something being present doesn't mean it caused the other. And learning that then allowed me to release any and all anger with him. And I'm using that now. And like, I hate saying this. It would be so much easier to just blame him. And by the way, I'm not going to tell him this yet. I'm not going to say this yet. I mean, I kind of have, like with the budget. I'm like, you know, and it's me too, honey, because he feels really bad. And he's like, oh my God. And I'm like, no, you know, it's me too. You know, I definitely, my pre-workout's expensive. You know, like I've taken some accountability. But between you and me, I know that there's more that I can do here. And it's empowering for me. And it's also healing for my marriage and for our relationship. So I would love to hear what you guys think about this, how this relates to you at home. If it does, welcome to any and all new listeners. You're in the right place. And if you have recently embarked on a journey of change in the new year, congratulations and welcome. There's so much beauty in sobriety, if that's what you're looking for, or in just releasing some other negative pattern. If it's overeating, if it's overworking, there's so much work that we can do as human beings just together in a space like this, where we can increase the quality of our lives and the impact of our lives. So thank you guys so much. Monday, this coming Monday, is my 9 years. I can't believe it. I'm going to do a cold plunge with Skylar, a sauna and cold plunge. Okay, this is me saving money, by the way. So normally where we go to do breath work and cold plunge, dude, a drop-in is $40. It would be $80 for us to go to this breathwork and cold plunge. Now, granted, they're amazing, but still, $80, really? So I found another place, which is even going to be better because they just let you go in. You can bring a guest. You book the hour for $39 total, and then you get to bring a guest, and it's just me and him, and we can do our own breathwork and pop in the cold plunge and do the sauna. So I'm excited about that. That's going to be fun. And I will have another new episode for you guys next week. I also think I got hooked up with being able to record in a studio, which would be really cool. But anyways, I love you guys. Thank you for joining me again this week. And please, please let me know what you think about this episode and what your thoughts are. Thank you guys so much.